All right.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to On Point. I'm Don Allen, and in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, good morning on this overcast Saturday
afternoon. Don, it's afternoon, 3 o'clock,
yeah,
Saturday daylight time. Yes, sir.
I've been going straight here. It feels like morning. Anyway,
I know.
Anyway, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of silence, a lot of leaders ducking and dodging, a lot of behind closed doors meetings, and, you know, we got to bring it all out to the light so people can get a clear shot of what's going on in our beloved city here.
Oh, definitely. And, I mean, there's, boy, a lot of clandestine kinds of activities going on. I was waiting for some kind of announcement, Don.
Yeah?
As we move into tonight's program, that how many youth jobs will be made available for African-American youth this summer. And I just was told by reliable sources there's really no program nor any goals.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you 100%. And someone had sent me an email earlier talking about the City of Minneapolis Step Up program, but for North Minneapolis, Emerge, from what I understand, only had 40 slots for 40 youth. And, you know, those youth are scrutinized, and it's not like back in Mr. Edwards in the old days when they had, you know, Peter Herrilla running the Neighborhood Youth Corps, where if you were 14 years old in the Minneapolis Public Schools or St. Paul Public Schools, you could get a job just by expressing that you wanted to work. It wasn't a detailed interview and, you know, who your parents and where you come from. It's just like they gave the kids the opportunity to work.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead, please.
And people need to recognize that and know that in our beloved enclave, because the alternative that's now being discussed is that, of course, this will mean more young African-Americans incarcerated during the summer, getting them at ages 13, 14, 12, 15, into the criminal justice system, which will have a significant impact later on in their lives with respect to meaningful employment. And by the way, man, have you paid your Verizon bill? Oops.
Oh, yeah. I called him up, Mr. Edwards, and we had a 15-minute conversation about, you know, them releasing my information to the Obama administration.
Absolutely.
And
I thought there should be a special program, a kind of a tier level, in which we as customers are informed immediately when the federal authorities request our information.
Mm-hmm.
And the right to listen to not only all of our conversations, but to read our emails, to take a look at the video pictures. You know, there's some folks out there that got some videos in their phones that I don't think they want the wife or the church or somebody else to see. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm
saying? Hey, you know, speaking of the youth, too, Mr. Edwards, the St. Louis Park, and this is kind of strange, St. Louis Park Patch came out with a story that a report, I should say, blacks in Hennepin County much more likely to be arrested for marijuana than anything else, basically, for small amounts. And you said that statewide, the arrest rate for blacks was 7.8 times the rate of whites, while whites had about 107 arrests per 100,000 people, and blacks had 835 arrests per 100,000 people. So, I feel there's a little bit of profiling going on there, and some knuckleheadness on our side. You don't walk down the middle of the street. Like yesterday, I was in downtown Minneapolis driving down Hennepin Avenue, and I had the window down because, you know, yesterday here, Mr. Edwards, it was cool outside, so you got why not hear it. There was four young men on the 7th and Hennepin between the Pantages Theater and the nightclub, smoking a big blunt. And just the smell just permeated, you know. And I'm like, oh, man, you guys are on camera. Are you that stupid? So
they had no idea. Didn't have a clue.
Didn't have a clue,
I bet. Mm-hmm. Right, so, let's give that phone number so these phone lines are open as we go to the Franklin case being sent over to the grand jury. Let's give that phone number. People may want to call.
Sure. The phone lines are open right now, and the phone number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904, and you're listening to On Point, the Ron and Don Show. Mr. Edwards.
Yes, sir. Coming to you on Blog Radio.
Yes.
America. Say, I just had a long conversation with some associates around the country. We would be irresponsible as black journalists and bloggers if we did not mention how many black blog radio and radio personalities are being taken off the air.
Mm-hmm.
I got a list, if you will, was provided to me a couple hours ago by a observer person that follows this. Man, you know, with the exception of my man Joe Madison, I mean, they're knocking, of course, Sharpton, they're knocking blacks off of radio, be it blog radio, commercial radio. There's a young cat by the name of Anderson who is starting a radio network, like, what is it, FX and things
yes.
like that. But they are knocking, like the Stewart brothers who were legendary in the world of sports. They were coming out of Atlanta a year ago. Sports radio knocked them right out of the box, said that they were a little too edgy. That's a white word for a little too urban.
Yes, exactly.
And we need to maybe begin to keep track. We maybe need to provide next week a memorial list of those of our profession that have been forced off of the mediums, if you will, be it blog radio, commercial radio, talk radio, and et cetera.
And I agree. And Mr. Edwards, we have a call.
Let's get it.
Okay. Yes, caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, just in a queue.
Okay, thank you. Okay, all right, we have just someone in the queue.
People listening.
Great. Yes.
Well, let's get to in the what is now becoming one of the most celebrated cases of the death of a young African-American at the hands of law enforcement, the Minneapolis Police Department. Minneapolis Star Tribune, and I guess a copyrighted story, reports that the Minneapolis Police Department has sent for our listeners domestically and internationally, the T.T. Franklin case has now been handed off to the county attorney, which is interesting because though the article written by Matt McKinney, he of that infamous story of May 17th and 18th, that the investigation has been completed. Don, the investigation has not been completed. The forensic evidence and toxicology tests and et cetera have not been certified. I mean, why would a so-called prestigious paper do that?
And you're absolutely right, Mr. Edwards, because I'm actually looking at this in Studio A, and the subtext or the subtitle of the story is, then grand jury could consider charges in Uptown incident. Charges against who? I mean, Matt McKinney wrote this story, county attorney's office to review Terrence Franklin's, but we all know already, Mr. Edwards, that the Star Tribune is the public relations arm for the city of Minneapolis to begin
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely.
So with that said, you know, this is actually covering the city's butt to make it seem like, okay, we had this big protest. Well, not us, but, you know, the people that went out there and protest. And again, I just have to add something here real quick, Mr. Edwards, because I've gotten some feedback. I don't protest. I stay in my lane and report news. And there are those
uh-huh.
that stay in their lane and do the protest. So I'm
uh-huh.
happy for you. I support you. I will support you. But don't come on me. Don't come down on me because I'm not out there marching in the streets with you. Okay, believe
yeah.
me.
Yeah, I've never been a marcher because I'm not a pacifist, and I came out of the so-called golden era of protests and et cetera, the late 1950s and particularly through the turbulent 1960s. And
mm-hmm.
I'm not a passive. I'm not a passive person. I'm not a peaceful protester. You spit on me. You call me a name, you're up close to me, we're going to get up close and personal kind of thing. Okay, so I've never been a marcher, and I respect those that do that. But when I start seeing bogus numbers, you know, there were not 500 protesters, there was approximately 104, because they should have known that the police were sitting up there with cameras and counted every one of them, ran everyone's face on the National Crime Computer Intelligence Network. The same people that listen in on your phone calls, contrary to what President Obama said yesterday, listen to everything you said. But anyways, you know, they ran a search checking for records and other kinds of subversive activities, if you will. By the way, the strategy of County Attorney Mike Freeman is to hold this investigation at bay for about 5 to 6 months, either send it to a currently impaneled grand jury or a newly impaneled, depending on the time of year and which grand jury's time is up and et cetera. There will be no indictment of any police officers, if you will. They were the only witnesses, per se, along with the dog, of the events leading to the death of T.T. Franklin. So the purpose will be to cleanse, okay? And it's important that we say that here on this program, that the key element to protect the city from liability damage, you know, like in the situation with David Cornelius Smith, $3 million and et cetera, is to provide the necessary protection as it pertains to DNA and et cetera. And as I've said numerous times, in order to protect the city as it pertains to liability, there must be DNA from Mr. Franklin on the MP5 that he allegedly took from Officer Durant, you know, if any such situation really happened. So they've got to work on getting that his DNA on that MP5. And we last week pointed out, and we also pointed out our own TV program for airing this past Sunday and again this coming Sunday, the blood splatter, Mr. Allen, on the MP5 is not consistent with Mr. Franklin's blood splatter and him holding the weapon, holding the MP5.
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Blood splatter does not scientifically correspond. And so they're going to have to work on that, as we said, on our television program emanating here in the city of Minneapolis, is that very peculiar pattern in the nozzle of the gun, which makes it pretty much impossible for you to, if I've got the gun and I'm pointing it, pretty difficult for my blood spatter to some way or another go out and then curve and come back into the nozzle of the MP5.
Exactly.
Particularly in that we're indoors, okay? Also, I noticed in the article that you have there in Studio 8 is that now McKinney and them are saying that there were close quarters in that basement. We first broke that story on the 11th of May on this very program, that it was in the basement, it was close quarters, hand-to-hand combat, fierce and intense, according to the descriptions given by the authorities. But there will be no attempt to examine really the conduct of the police. They will hold Mr. Franklin, the deceased, at fault, if you will. And when the grand jury convenes, it will be like 99% of grand juries here in the state of Minnesota and in the Twin Cities. It will be an all-white grand jury.
Yes, it sure will. And Ms. Edwards, from a good source, you know, Terrence Mookie Franklin had no military training, number one. And in the Star Tribune report here, it says it was in a tight, like you stated earlier, tight, cramped basement where the conflict took place. And there's too many variables and derivatives to think that a man being beat and like he was beat and then shot would even reach and grab an officer's weapon. You know, that'd be like one of us getting pulled over and two cops come to the car and you reach out and you grab the police or attempt to grab the police officer's weapon. You will instantly get one to the head from his partner. There's no questions asked there.
Well, here's the cover story that is going to be developed. They sampled it. Let me use that word. They've sampled it a couple times over the last couple of weeks, because it's been now a month since the tragedy. They're talking in terms that at some point he was suicidal, that this was, as was in the case of Santa Monica, California, yesterday, and that tragedy out there, mass shootings. It was that Mr. Franklin at some point in time decided that he wanted to commit suicide, and so that he committed suicide by at the hands of a police officer kind of thing, you know. That's absolutely untrue. As I said, and I've said in a number of my reflections and publications, Mr. Franklin was unconscious when he was shot. Don?
Yes, yes.
He was beaten
yes.
into unconsciousness with the fist and the flashlight and the situation with the dog, if you will. All of that was happening. He was unconscious when they shot him. And also, I just don't know where people came up with being shot in the back of the head kind of thing. Because if you understand confines, structures, and confines within those structures and et cetera, it's one of the reasons why the Star Tribune did not do a illustration, because there was a illustration in the files that they were allowed to illegally access, if you will, when they were given the password, oops, and access the investigative file, in which there's now a very intense investigation going on within the department. Mike Freeman in the county attorney's office will sanitize that also, by the way. But
oh, wow.
this whole, you know, pretense of any number of situations taking place which gives credence to whatever the police department's version will be, that's really what's going to be worked on. And it's really sad.
Well,
go ahead, Ms. Al.
Well, Ms. Edwards, since you, you know, you're familiar with the city ordinance and regulations, et cetera, I need to examine you on some things. You know, the first point would be, what is the standing of Police Chief Jhené Hartle's involvement of this? Because she's in my opinion, a poor representation of the Minneapolis Police Department and in this investigation and her police officers. And is there some kind of rogue underlying establishment that is
normally
really...
what departments do, it oftentimes varies. It depends upon the sophistication of the department. To handle the dissemination of information. First of all, Chief Harto should have utilized her deputy chief for investigations, number one. Number two, the head of her homicide unit. Number three, the head of internal affairs. She should have utilized those three personnel and not made herself as vulnerable as she did. She is not a good... speaker, and particularly in terms of extreme grandishly, does not speak well off on her feet, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
What happens now is that that will be handled by attorneys, and that's the reason you hurry up and get the case quicker than usual, by the way, to the county attorney. Those are lawyers gifted with gab, if you will. What they will basically do, with the exception of information being leaked to Matt McKinney and David Chenin, they will basically hold community at bay, and even the attorney or attorneys for the family of the deceased, by indicating this is a current and ongoing investigation. That's an old standard. What they really are having a problem with right now, Mr. Allen, is that it's like the term we used on last week's program. This is like synchronized swimming, and the officer's testimony has to be synchronized, okay? Because at some point in front of the grand jury, even though, you know, this will be an all-white grand jury, by and large, even some of the folks on the grand jury will ask to see, you know, illustrations of the scene in the basement. What was the recollection of the officers involved, of where they were at different points in time, if you will. Then the so-called autopsy will be called into play. I'm not sure that Dr. Baker will be called, but one of his assistants, if you will. I thought it was a disaster for a activist by the name of Mel Reeves, who made the statement that his source was the medical examiner by virtue of his statement that our source are the people that examine the body, if you will. You never identify your source. Even David Chenin and them didn't do that, okay? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of rumors out here now, Some are saying that the leak actually came from the Sheriff's Department. Oops. And it came through two officers who are notorious with respect for their disdain and hatred for African Americans, including their own fellow black officers, Sergeant King and Lieutenant Smith, Annie Smith. And so it was getting testy out there. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Internal investigations going on and et cetera. And so it was thought better to hand this damn thing off to the county attorney. He's well versed at how to work and cover these things up. It'll be about 6 months, and we will have moved on to other things in the world as we know it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
And then they will basically come back with a sanitation and cleansing.
And
it will be no probable cause.
Yeah. And speaking of sanitation and cleansing, in the article written by Matt McKinney on June 7th, 2013 at 10:52 p.m., continuing with this same case but a different individual, I need to read this to you. Under the auspices, Mr. Edwards, of what you said about sanitizing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
There's a paragraph in the story that says, about 30 minutes after the shooting, a second person died when a police SUV rushing to the shooting scene with flashing lights and siren blaring collided with a motorcyclist, Ivan Romero, 24, at the Minneapolis intersection. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, as far as sanitizing goes, you know, he writes this as if the Minneapolis Police Department made every effort to let this individual know, or anybody out there know, that this particular SUV was rushing to a scene of a shooting. But as we found out later here, Mr. Edwards, this was a half hour after the Code 4 had been called. And so,
yeah,
again,
right,
the Star and Tribune is, again, you know, the public relations arm for the Minneapolis Police Department and the city of Minneapolis by sanitizing that piece. And he didn't really go into depth at all about the detail that we know already as being factual. So,
well, let me say on that particular point, Mr. Allen, a keen observation, because one of the things that they are trying to cover up and sanitize as it pertains to the Romero killing, a young Latino hit by the SUV and killed instantly, is that Lieutenant Jack Kelly, without appropriate consultation with officers on the scene at 2717 Bryant Avenue South at that time, Lieutenant Jack Kelly called off the operation, if you will, which meant that there should have been no flashing lights, there should have been no siren. In fact, there was really no need to go in that direction, if you will, at anything exceeding a speed limit of 20 to 25 miles, which is what the speed limit is basically on that particular street, Blaisdell. Again, Lieutenant Jack Kelly called that operation off. And if you talk in terms of the Minneapolis Star Tribune's role in discussing the Romero death, they don't even talk about that as if they also have not had some access to the investigative report and investigative file on that one. Keen observation on your point there. Again, Lieutenant Jack Kelly called the operation off. The operation had been off for quite some time. And yet the police department's SUV was still in route. And now you got McKinney saying with lights and siren blaring. Yet Chief Harto, and it goes back to the question you examined me on earlier, Chief Harto indicated, quote unquote, that the video of the squad car that was following the SUV, I guess they kind of had like a caravan, indicates that the speed of the SUV was anywhere between 15 and 20 miles an hour, which is rather interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And also, Mr. Edwards, on another tier involving the same story, the same case, we've heard nothing, silent, about the young lady that was on the back of the motorcycle that was in Hennepin County, Mr. Romero's girlfriend, allegedly. We've heard not a word.
In that particular case, they spent an inordinate amount of time trying to determine her immigration status, And as we first exclusively reported on this program on the 18th and again on the 25th of May, is that she was, her room in the hospital was right next to the room of the two officers who, you know, allegedly were shot by Mr. Franklin. And you have to understand the terror and the fear that goes with a situation in which, you know, you're looking at all these uniformed officers with their guns. No one has been able to explain why she was put in a room next to these police officers with that much traffic going back and forth. The word is that initially when they tried to question her, she was on top of her game and declined to answer any questions, which is consistent with what's going on because none of the police officers involved in those two incidents, and there would have been a total of six who were actually what you call operational officers, they didn't, you know, they didn't give any statements or anything. In fact, I'm not sure that the, I guess they finally did when the department in the last couple of days decided to send the case over to the county attorney. I guess the two officers who were wounded allegedly by Mr. Franklin finally gave their statements almost 3 weeks after the shooting.
Wow. Oh,
but
okay.
In your question about the young lady, an inordinate amount of time was spent working with ICE. That's, you know, immigration, naturalization component, to try to determine what her status was and use that as an instrument of intimidation. Though there's not a lot that she could have remembered based on the speed of the entire incident, the vehicle hitting. Well, actually, the story was that the motorbike, it wasn't a motorbike, let me just be, it was a very expensive motorcycle that he had legally obtained. He bought it with his money working at the bakery. Because they maintain that the motorcycle hit the back end of the SUV. I took a look at pictures that I saw. I just couldn't see where the damage was. I know there was damage under the front left fender of the SUV. You could see that damage there, which would imply something hit the front part, the driver's side well, if you will, wheel well. But hey, you know, in her case, I mean, what could you expect? You know, I'm also troubled by the information that she received, and this comes from witnesses, including three lawyers, that she never received any medical attention as she actually lay there in the street.
Wow.
Until the emergency medical technicians, EMTs, arrived. So I don't know what the current status is. I assume, I hope she has an attorney or attorneys, if you will. I hope that they are certainly protecting what constitutional rights should be accorded to her, if you will. Anything else in that McKinney story? You say McKinney posted that when?
That was on, we get back there, the June 7th at 10:52 p.m.
Okay. And he was in preparation for the story in this morning's edition of the paper, talking about the case being sent to the county attorney. By the way, our good friends at the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and the so-called, what is it called, the Police Community Relations Office, which supplanted the and succeeded the Civilian Review Authority, which was a disaster from the get-go. I understand that the Civil Rights Department is indicating that they will do all that is directed to them to get information to make sure that information is forwarded to the authorities against the interest of the communities of color.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
you know,
yeah,
by the way, that Civil Rights Department is quite a thing. Do you know that they have an employee there who actually really never does any work in contract compliance, and he's the director there, that he has a business and he has contracts with DOT?
Oh, yeah.
For services rendered. He sells computer systems and programs. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, didn't he try to approach you for a purchase?
Oh yeah. This young man, he's a doozy, Mr. Edwards, and very interesting setup that these folks have down there in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and the contract compliance area. And so, I mean, with that said, you know, we need to focus some attention on them because I was driving down University Avenue between Broadway and Hennepin, and I counted four or five crews putting in sidewalks and no African-American, no Hispanic, no Asian, no Somalian, and there are about 30 men out there working. So instead of being down there working on your own personal projects with MnDOT, I think you should be out in the field doing some contract compliance.
Well, let me say on that particular point for our listening audience, again, our phone lines are open. There is a brand new pretty building going up right across from the NSP, now XL Center, right there on the Nicollet Mall. And we have been watching that facility as it started from the ground up. And there has not been a single African-American or person of color who has been working on that particular site right there at Nicollet Mall and the transit. And that ties into an article in which the director of contract compliance for the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and a good friend of yours, the head of the so-called Office of Diversity at the University of Minnesota, Craig Taylor. And they're in this article. It appeared in the Minnesota Daily, right?
And we've not
moved off, of course, anything that anyone may want to ask about Franklin. But they were talking about the wonderful job they've been doing. In fact, they finally increased their goals for the first time since 1999. And Mr. Taylor is quoted as talking about the wonderful job and access that persons of color have on university projects. And what I'm looking at here in Studio B that you see me looking down at is that I am looking at a series of email intercepts involving the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, University of Minnesota, on the then construction of the Fairview University of Minnesota Children's Hospital, in which a longtime employee, who in fact lost his job along with the late Corky Taylor, is being told to falsify information. And this was the individual named Eddie Calderon, a Filipino national who, of course, was a naturalized American citizen. And in these emails, he is actually being told by a city attorney, assistant city attorney, to falsify and violate the law and falsify the numbers as it pertains to diversity on the University of Minnesota's Fairview Children's Hospital. Mm. So, and this is the same Craig Taylor that sat on the committee, the oversight committee, with Velma Corvell and the then head of the St. Paul Human Rights Department and a couple of others, and falsified documentation as it pertains to the construction of the school district's headquarters at 1250 West Broadway. This is the same Craig Taylor, right?
Yes, it is. And that article can be found in it's Minneapolis Sets Diversity Goals for City Contracts, May 31st, 2013, by Megan Holden. But, Mr. Edwards, I have to read something absolutely hilarious to you.
Okay.
About four paragraphs down, it says, after the Economic Policy Institute named Minneapolis as having the worst unemployment disparities between white and black citizens in 2010, the city began to take steps to remedy this problem. Really?
Really?
Okay.
Wow.
Really? And it quotes in here, Michael McHugh, Assistant Director for the City of Minneapolis Contract Compliance Division, said the high goals are obtainable because there is a large number of women and minority-owned business available to do smaller projects. The City of Minneapolis, the Civil Rights Department, more specifically, the Contract Compliance Division, has yet to show any qualitative and quantitative information that that statement by Mr. McHugh is correct. Okay.
Let me say how bad this is to our listeners, and again, the phone lines are open. I'm going to read over the air, Mr. Allen, here from my perch in the studio. These are emails in which Edward A. Calderon, a 32-year employee who was fired by Velma Corvell because he complained about the corruption in the Minneapolis City Civil Rights Department. I'm looking at an email, Mr. Allen. We'll have one of the staff carry it over to you. I'm looking at an email dated Thursday, May 20th, 2010, at approximately 9:41 a.m. From Mr. Calderon, to responsible authorities, talking in terms of the directives and orders he had just been given with respect to falsifying information. I have another email the previous day on Wednesday, May 19th, 2010, at approximately 9:01 a.m. from Edward Calderon, talking in terms of being directed by a man by the name of Johnny Burns, who is now deputy director for the State Human Rights Department, directing he, Mr. Calderon, to falsify information and to accept whatever numbers were given to him by the construction doing business on the facility that we previously identified involving University of Minnesota, Mr. Taylor, and others. Okay, there are a whole series, if you will, of emails from Mr. Calderon. As we said, Mr. Calderon, as an outgrowth of this action, was summarily discharged, fired, 32-year, and immediately following him was the late Corky Taylor, who had 35 years in as a actually, at one point, he was the director of contracts, and he was, quote-unquote, terminated because of his support, along with the head of investigations, of Mr. Ronald Brandon, who raised questions about the level of corruption under Velma Corvell, Michael Brown, and others. All these people were discharged, as well as a woman by the name of Lauren Marker, who, and two of the individuals are deceased, Ms. Marker, and the late Corky Taylor. This they were referred to as the Unholy Four. We've written a little bit about it in some of our columns in the largest black newspaper in the state of Minnesota, Post and Recorder. But I'm looking and have had in my possession, obviously, since 2010, these documents, this protesting by Mr. Calderon, who it really should be identified as a hero, who lost his job and everything else as an outgrowth of this. By the way, as a part of this, how we were able to also identify falsification of documents, I have in part of my file, investigative file, the mileage sheets of personnel in the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department who were falsifying. Do we have something?
Oh, no. Go ahead. I'm just like cracking up that you have that.
Oh, yeah, we have the mileage. I have the mileage sheets just so they used an entity called Our Car, HOURCAR. This identifies, so the city should know, identifies each and every individual and the amount of travel and et cetera that they said they did, the amount of money that they were recouping from the city when, in fact, they were doing no on-sites and et cetera. And by the way, on that particular point, let us now quickly, for those that might be concerned, let us bring our attention to a devastating audit by the state of Minnesota of the Department of Transportation's Office of Civil Rights. You remember how we had a gentleman on this program a couple years ago, who Mr. Lenny Chisholm, who was put off the committee because he raised questions?
Yes, yes.
Well, people need to know that in a report dated May 13, 2013, audit of the Office of Civil Rights DBDE program, that the authorities confirmed what Mr. Chisholm had said and what Mr. Allen and Mr. Edwards had been supporting him and what we had also been saying. They talk in terms of just unbelievable corruption. Ms. Prescott, the head of the office, was relieved of duties, but actually she was given really a lateral transfer. In fact, she's now only 4 minutes away from her home in Maplewood. So contrary to what was said. But one of the things that this audit shows is that many of our African-American leaders, if you will, were a party to this sham and violation of the law.
Oh, yes. You're absolutely correct.
And it makes for interesting reading. There's been an attempt. There have been a series of meetings involving a number of so-called African-American general contractors here, as well as OIC and others, Thor Construction, and et cetera, trying to suppress this report from being disseminated within the community. And I guess in some respects they probably have. But under the Freedom of Information Act, I would encourage all of y'all that are out there listening. It's entitled Minnesota Department of Transportation Office of Audit, MS-19395 John Ireland Boulevard, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55155. And you may want to go directly to the office of the commissioner of the Department of Education and ask for a copy of the May 13, 2013 audit. And the condemnation of criminal corruption and et cetera, and the immediate departure of Mary Prescott, who was the longtime head of the Civil Rights Office. I'm telling you, Don, it is an interesting document. And let me just say, joining with the activities of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and its Office of Contract Compliance as well as Office of Investigation, these auditors went in and found all these backdated documents and falsified documents and forged documents, and it made sense with respect to the figures that you've been giving along with Mr. Chisholm for 3 years about how little money was spent with the African-American community.
You're absolutely correct, Mr. Edwards. They are stone-cold-faced liars. And just I have to share this with you right here. I have a copy of the report over here open in Studio A because I was really excited to get to this because 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, going backwards and forwards there, we've been saying that these numbers are lies. We've been attacked by people like Louis King, Reverend Jerry McAfee, Al McFarland, chairman of the board of the Minneapolis Urban League and the Insight News publisher, tons of the usual suspects. And so in 2010, percentage of dollars given to DBE, according to the MnDOT report, was 5.6%. They applauded that. They had a party around that, Mr. Edwards. In 2011, they said, well, we went up. We did $7.6 of dollars we got in to the African-American community. This white auditor, okay, who knows his stuff, confirmed that when we were calling them liars, they were calling them. They were saying, well, Don Linney and everyone else, you all don't know what you're talking about. The auditor says, and I quote, "We have concluded that these participation rates are unsubstantiated. Auditor asked for the documents or calculations to support the above claims. For some reason, the information and calculations were not retained." Okay? So this stuff trickles down from the state to the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights Contract Compliance. All their stuff is bogus, period.
Absolutely. The numbers are absolutely – and let me just say, because we are only doing an hour program this afternoon.
And we have a call also when you get
ready. Oh, let's get the caller.
Caller, sorry for holding you so long. You're live on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go right in. You're on the air.
Yes. My name is Trish Edwards. I had talked to you guys some months ago about my nephew, Anton Warner, Ramon Stevens' murder case.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
And I was wondering, have you guys heard anything yet?
Yeah, let me speak to that. We've continuously followed up. What we're being told is that there, you know, we keep hearing that story about that informant
mm-hmm.
who was in the federal facility there in Indiana who allegedly was one of the participants in the brutal murder of your loved ones, if you will. But that the federal authorities are resisting allowing the individual to be interrogated because of his importance in a number of government operations moving drugs in and through the black community. And so there has been no progress. In fact, it's basically been designated. And we're certainly happy that you called in because we were just talking about you in a production meeting. We're glad you called in because there's been very little pressure from the so-called black leadership in this city about this brutal murder, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are aware. In fact, some of them are associated with the gentleman who is in the federal facility in Indiana. That individual was involved in a number of operations with them as part of their activities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What I would make a suggestion that you do, we have a new chief here. Named Jean Harto. Give us a call after we go on the air. We'll make sure you get the right spelling. Because there's a new chief, I would strongly suggest that loved ones and members of the family petition the chief to state the status of the murder investigation and to meet with representatives of the family. You don't need to take no ministers or lawyers with you. Y'all go yourself, okay?
Okay, I will be going myself because I'm the one was around the corner when the murder occurred, but I didn't
know
that
right.
That was my nephew, right?
Yes.
And I seen the people, you know, the guys that were involved in it because they kept riding past me in the vehicles, you know, and I seen the vehicles and stuff. And also, I was at one of my friend's house one night. This was 5 months after the murder occurred.
Right.
It was supposed to have been the guy, Damon Moore. He supposed to have shot in my friend's house while I was in there.
Yeah,
he did.
That's right.
And he came, him and another guy came and kicked her door in twice and tore her house up.
Yes.
And they know I know what happened in my heart, you know, and there was supposed to be 7 men and 2 women that's involved in this murder. They was in the home when it happened.
That's right. They were part of the torture and the murder of your loved ones.
Yes.
The plan had been hatched with the knowledge of authorities.
Yes, because
one
of the girls.
Go ahead. Because you had talked about but people need to be familiarized. Go ahead. You were going to say about the young ladies.
Well, one of them, you know, talked to me on and off, and she is not aware that I really know that she's involved, but she's, you know, telling on herself. She told me that 12 set the murder up. She said that he was, she said that Ricky Stokes and Butch had called her phone and asked to pick her up to go to Anton's Warren house at night. And I know in my heart that she's involved in that because she said 12 asked her which one had the money in a safe, and she said he had 5 safes in the house, 4
that's
small
right.
ones and 1 big one.
That's absolutely correct. Let me also say this, and what this young lady, that this caller is saying, can always be recaptured on these programs through demand. What this caller is saying to us, she said approximately a year ago, one of the things that happened is that one of the individuals that you're talking about, a conversation between him and another individual who was under electronic surveillance. If you remember, you talked to us about a year ago about a telephone call that was made within less than a half hour after the brutal murders, in which an individual called someone in, if I'm not mistaken, East Chicago, and was telling them about how the murders took place. And yet when he was questioned by the authorities, he maintained that he was nowhere in the vicinity. But the feds had the electronic intercept, as we call it, of him telling someone within minutes after that brutal murder that this had just happened, which meant that he had to be at the scene to call somebody down in East Chicago. Am I correct in what I just said to you?
Yes, you are. And also one of his family members I was kind of close with, her mother grew up with my sister Toni Anton's mother.
Mm-hmm.
She had gave me a call and told me that she knew in her heart that her cousin is involved in a murder. And also, Damon Moore's sister gave some information out to another family member, and it got back to me stating that he called the sister to pick him up, and he was in front of the house when Anton and Ramon's body was in the home, still in the room, and he was walking up and down the street, and the sister said, "Something wrong? Yes, get me away from here." And he told what happened. She said, "Call the police." He said, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And she took him on to her house.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I know in my heart that they have something to do with this. And that day when Anton and Ramaz was in the house dead, we all was outside and we was talking to the media.
Mm-hmm.
But after I got done talking to the media, I came out and said, I seen the vehicles. They kept riding past me. I said, a white Buick LeSabre 2004. It's a four-door, and it was a Nissan Sentra, like a 1989 spray paint.
Yes, you did, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, so I came out and said the name of the vehicles, and 12 got nervous and was walking back and forth across the street and said, that's Naeem Jones' car, a guy that used to be one of my nephew roommates. He's in jail right now serving 7 years for a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And we know all these guys have something to do with this murder. And also we gave a candlelight visual, made a 20th. We knew that it happened May the 21st. No, it was May the 19th.
Mm-hmm.
We gave the visual, me and my sister, them, and none of his friends showed up. It was just the little family members. We decorated the tree and everything, stayed over there for a while. So I spoke to one of the neighbors. I told the neighbor that we was over there giving the thing. We didn't want to cause no problems. And later, the neighbor said that she know what happened. She told me.
Ooh.
Yes,
oh, yes, yes, yes. And so do the authorities, both on the state / city and federal side. As I said, a person now currently being held at the federal facility in Marion, Indiana, was a police operative, if you will. It was conversations intercepted and recorded by him during the course of the planning of the murder of your two loved ones that the feds have. But their position was that this person is untouchable because they intend to, Mr. Allen, put him back out in the general quote-unquote population to continue to do what he does best.
Wow. Right, but in my
but
heart,
we appreciate stay in touch with us.
I will.
I want you to get my number and we will talk more privately because this is a very dangerous situation. And there are currently law enforcement officers who are working to make sure this stays covered up.
Okay.
Thank you for calling.
Can I say one more thing before we hang up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That night when he shot in my friend's house, thank God it didn't touch me. He shot upstairs, and my friend recognized that it was 12 and his friend. He looked out the window, and they kicked on my car and bust my lights out, my back lights in my car.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a meeting. Okay, I'll tell you
more
later.
Go ahead. We don't want to cut you off.
They had a meeting with my name in it and said that I knew everything would happen. And they was planning on trying to, you know, harm me. But I'm not afraid of them. I fear the Lord, not them. And
okay.
I just pray and hope that God, you know, punish these people and lock them up because they need to get off the streets.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. By the way, Mr. Allen, some of these individuals were involved in the double homicide at the Zodiac Club, in North Minneapolis, actually in that immediate vicinity just a couple months ago.
Wow, that's not good.
What else we have? Phone number? We still got a couple minutes for any phone calls. Anyone wants to check in with us?
Sure. That number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Give us a call. The phone lines are open. And, Mr. Edwards, we were talking. We had left off with the I'm just looking at this report from MnDOT.
The audit report. Yes. Go ahead.
It says the Office of Civil Rights executed a contract with the University of Minnesota for $48 million to set a goal for the following 3 years from 2013 to 2015.
Right, right.
The U of M Minnesota study determined a goal of 13%, that they're going to reach a goal of 30%. A memo obtained by the audit office October 7th indicates the rate proposed by the U of M may not have been accepted by the Civil Rights Office and determined method may have been used to calculate a rate of 10.3%.
10.3, that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yep.
So
we're looking at the same page.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I would refer people to finding number 4, poor record keeping and backdated documents. I would call under the narrative as an example the situation with a company identified as Lurand Construction, spelled LUNDA Construction Company, which had a very cozy relationship with the Department of Transportation. It is a part of this audit examination, and it's frightening with respect to the kind of criminal activities that took place. Starting on December 20th, 2010, culminating on May 18th, 2011, when documents were backdated and falsified and numbers were changed. Some of your African-American leadership were members of the committee and were very much involved in helping with the cover-up.
Yes. And it was a huge, huge cover-up, Mr. Edwards, because they did not want – I went to several of the collaborative meetings where they had Emma Corey that works at MnDOT to take over, and they hired this other young lady, this African-American woman, to do some community outreach. And these people were not doing anything. And I would raise the questions. I mean, if you're trying to get build DBEs and use them and give them contracts, how come you're not doing that? And they said, and what they would do is they would do like Christopher Columbus did to the Native Americans. You know, they put them up on the stage and say, these are our two Negro contractors that are dusting off the rocks on 35E close to downtown St. Paul to beautify it. They received the contract.
That's
you know?
Right.
And we
by the way, just for the purpose of authenticating and authenticity, we would call your attention to this report to the Pacific Reflections by the auditor on the relationship of Donovan Trucking and the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of DOT, the kind of deals that were being and the kind of kickbacks that were going on. Again, I repeat and charge that individuals involved in the African-American leadership group and those that have been meeting for the last week in an attempt to suppress this report, their direct role in that particular criminal act.
And I would
in
like
the
to
report.
Quote, yeah, and we have a caller. Caller, stand by. But, Mr. Edwards, I would like to quote Met Council's Wanda Kirkpatrick in the meeting I had with her. And I quote, MnDOT got their hands in the Prime's pocket, end the quote. With that said,
gotcha.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Caller?
Oh,
come on,
that's,
Mark.
That's
Mark.
That's a Verizon tune. That's a tune that's from the Verizon Intercept Network. Hey, thank you, buddy, for calling in. Probably somebody with Homeland Security.
That's
supposed to be intimidating, by the way. But, you know, everybody has a network, if you will. Well, Mr. Allen, looks like we're coming up at the end. We only have an hour program today. Wanted to try to get that information out, if you will, for you leaders that have been meeting for the last 10 days to try to help out and suppress this audit report on criminal activities and falsification of numbers and the denial of African Americans to enjoy some of the lucrative returns. Shame on you, shame on you, shame on you.
Yes, yes, and we'll have an update on that next week. But also, Mr. I just wanted to interject something there. There's been a deafening silence ever since the protests for Terrence Mookie Franklin, and those that were involved in the protests have yet to come up with a second tier plan of attack or of engagement.
That's
with
correct.
Anybody.
And Mr. Franklin deserved better. I do not refer to him by the name Mookie. That's a street name.
Okay.
White folks hear names like that, and they equate those names to criminals and criminal activities. So I have to let you know, Mr. Allen, I do not use that street name.
Okay, gotcha.
But you've been absolutely correct. There's not been a backup. Where's the backup plan? We suggested last week for those that were calling, telling us to recognize those that were doing something, we suggested that those were doing something, that they needed to immediately approach the county and the U.S. Attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota and ask for an immediate grand jury investigation. See, the problem is Mike Freeman has already laid out the timeline, and it will be at least 6 months before there will be a determination of no probable cause of police misconduct. Oops.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we have another caller. We have another caller. We have a couple minutes.
Oh, here. Do we have enough time? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay,
you know
caller,
what? Because I'm... Yep, it's a caller, and I'm just talking about Minneapolis because I'm ready to go back home so bad, but Indiana ain't shit either. Sorry if I curse. This Minnesota. Somebody gave me this number and told me I can be heard on the radio, so I'm like, let me call it. All these murderers, and then you know what? Give it out. Shout out to the youngsters for playing their own selves. Because you got the police running all around and interrupting your lives when you're trying to make something out of yourself, but you're ruining your own self. Shout out to them. Shout out to the killers and the murderers and doing all this that y'all do. Let's shout out to those murderers. Let's shout out to those killers. Let's shout out to these little young drug dealers and 13 years old running around with a gun. Let's do shout out to them.
All right.
Let's shout out to
them. Call in early next week and get the full flavor of your reflection.
Thank you, sister. Let's shout out to the youngsters.
And of course, Mr. Edwards, with less than 2 minutes left, we'd like to thank everybody for listening today to On Point Black Politics in Minneapolis, the Ron and Don Show. Any closing words, Mr. Edwards?
All I want to know is how much will be paid under the table because next Friday, the Sports Facility Authority will select the monitor, and Ms. Carvel and her crew feel that they'll be able to be the prevailing requester, if you will, because they got the plan to do the ban.
Okay.
All right, then.
Sounds good. Have a great day, everyone. We'll be back next week.